Welcome to Talk Without Borders. I'm your host, John Pitti. In this episode, I sat down with Christos Floros. Christos is president of DP International and an active voice in Luxembourg's political scene. He's very passionate and outspoken about strengthening civic engagement, defending European values, and shaping a more forward-looking political landscape. In our conversations, we explored the current and future political landscape in Luxembourg and the European Union, the importance of civic involvement in politics, and the pressing need to develop new social media platforms built on European values. We also touched on how emerging technologies, specifically artificial intelligence, are reshaping society and discussed the evolving relationship between Europe and the United States amidst recent political developments. You'll notice that our conversation is quite engaging and covers a wide variety of topics. What you're about to hear is two people having a meaningful, honest discussion about issues that affect all of us. It's not always perfect, and at times we find ourselves venturing into uncharted territory. But what matters is that the conversation is genuine, authentic, and driven by a good faith effort to explore ideas that deserve more attention. But now, without further ado, enjoy the conversation with Christos Floros. Hello, Christos. Welcome to my podcast. Great to have you.
Thank you for the invitation, John. It's great to see you.
I was wondering myself, because I was doing a little bit of research about you. You know, when you were little, when you were a kid, was it always an ambition of you to become or to be active in a political space or become a politician, or if you consider yourself a politician? Or is that something you just kind of grew into by accident or maybe even organically?
I've always wanted to contribute something to society. I've always seen myself as part of a society, a community, a group. And I think early on, based on my understanding of history, I made it clear to myself that contributing to the whole was important to me. I think being active in politics is an expression of care towards society. I don't see it the way that I think traditionally politics is being seen from the outside. I just think it's about participation, getting engaged. And so I've always had that. But I think the way you asked the question, I guess, is directed more to the traditional inclination towards politics. But I think...
Well, I'm asking because when I look at your vita, I saw you studied architecture first in England, in the UK, and needed a master's degree later on at the University of Luxembourg in European urbanization and globalization. And it's something I also found very interesting. You also trained actor. I think you did 3 years of acting school. So maybe in a way, maybe you combine all of the things that you did and learned and kind of translated that into the political sphere.
Okay. First of all, I think it's very interesting that you see that. Not a lot of people look at my life's story or my CV and see that link between things. It's true. I think I'm just endlessly curious, and I'm always constantly questioning my role within that society and how I can contribute to it. I think actors are very important people, artists in general. Actors are just, I think, the wonderful vessel of storytelling of our generation. But artists contribute immensely to our political thought through their art. They make us question, they make us empathize, they contextualize through music, through song, through paint, through video, through films. And architecture was as well a way for me to understand how we were building the future of Luxembourg at the time. You know, obviously I've had big picture views and smaller picture views, more focused views. So other than the personal and kind of anecdotal details of, you know, meeting an architect when I was very young and deciding that I wanted to pursue that and loving the idea that, you know, my family friend Paul Bledz had a dog and I wanted a dog. So that was the initial exploration of, well, why not architecture? But for me, it's always been about learning what I can so that I have enough knowledge to be able to have productive thoughts to contribute to something larger than me.
So the one thing that stuck out to me was the actor part, because, you know, in my mind, you know, obviously I'm not in the political sphere as much as you are, but it seems to me there's a, I would call a performative element But I lived in the United States for a very long time, so I understand that politics, there's a very big performative element. And that's not to say that your ideas or your presentation is not genuine, but it seems to me that there is an element of that.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Politics is performance. The worst people are on top, and I'll include myself in it. You know, I don't think the people in the front line of politics are not the experts. We're not. I'll include myself with the worst, and I'll exclude myself from the leadership, right? But there's absolutely an element of performance. When you look at most parliaments today, parliamentarians go up there and read speeches that a lot of the times they don't even understand, right? Which is not what an actor does, by the way. An actor performing a role and reading a play understands far better what he's saying in that political speech than the average politician understands in a parliament.
Mm-hmm.
100% of that. I'll just repeat it just to make sure I was very clear.
Right.
An actor reading, performing a political play understands more about the politics of what he's talking about than an actual elected politician in a parliament. 100%.
So are you saying that in that case, in that way, you have an advantage over politicians that are not trained actors?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Because acting teaches you more about human nature than any other discipline, especially when you're, you know, trained for theater, where you do full character explorations and you really work to understand the human being that you will eventually portray. Acting is a craft, man. It's amazing. It's incredible. And so, you know, anyone can be a politician, right? And that is on purpose. Anyone can be a politician, and that's what we want, right? You want the guy who wakes up in the morning and picks up eggs, you know, the farmer. You want him to be a politician, and you want the doctor to become a politician, and you want a woman who's spent, you know, 60 years of her life on entrepreneurial projects. You want her to, at, you know, age, I don't know, 75, if she feels interested in, to go into politics as well. You know, it doesn't matter if you're young or old. It doesn't matter what your experience is. You want everyone to go into politics in a representative system. But I think, yeah, actors can make excellent politician artists in general. And obviously, sometimes in a world of attention, fame can also support you. So some actors also become good politicians because they're able to be elected. But anyway, yeah.
I think this is very interesting. I think this kind of ties into, because I think right now we're in a crisis as it comes to how the general public or how people perceive politicians. You know, there's often a lot of mistrust, you know, some sort of hesitancy, you know, not being exactly sure if the ideas that are proposed are genuine. You know, you see this a lot right now. And, you know, how important is it to you, you know, that your ideas, your reflections are genuine and not just, you know, talking points? I can give you an example. The United States, the elections. I think part of why Trump got elected, definitely the first time, right, was a certain mistrust people had in the traditional politician. So, and he was a little bit outside of that. And I think that's how he got, you know, so much attention and, you know, he got so many votes. I think part of it was that he was just outside the normal sphere. So do you see that trend as well, that, you know, people are a little bit hesitant towards, let's say, career politicians?
Oof, you're opening again. And I feel like I also went on different avenues with my previous answer. I think you're opening up a huge point of discussion here.
Right. That's what I'm trying to do. Yeah.
Yeah. I think we're not going to solve it.
No, of course not.
In 1 hour conversation. But, and that's why I refer to excellent people that have already spoken about this previously. And by previously, I mean about 2000 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Right. We need to read the classics. We need to read the people that wrote about or spoke about or documented Athenian democracy, the documented the beginning of the Roman Republic and the descent of the Roman Republic into empire. So with that context, I always have a feeling, and that's why I don't refer to myself as a politician. I am a political being. I am a politician in the sense that, you know, in the Aristotelian way, I believe all good people aspire to be political beings, politicians, right? Not in the negative connotation that we have today of who is a politician. And having said that, I think the majority of people don't aspire to be politicians. And, you know, that makes me unelectable, and I hope nobody ever finds this podcast in the future. But I don't have a lot of time, personally. I get very frustrated with people that are, quote unquote, apolitical.
Interesting.
I just need to get okay with it, and I need to be able to apply the things that I read into my...
How do you get frustrated when you see somebody that's apolitical? How does that manifest itself?
Well, I mean, when I was younger, I would actually get angry. Now I just, you know, I understand either ignorance or, you know, lack of time, or if it's a young person that needs to have 3 or 4 jobs to survive and is apolitical, I think a person in that situation actually, I think, is more political than people give them credit for. But I have a huge distrust for rich kids that are apolitical. Like, I can't even.
Yeah, I can understand that.
This is you can tell in my face, you know, I know this is a voice podcast, but you can tell in my face. I mean, come on, like, the amount of luxury and privilege required.
And power, right?
Yeah.
Responsibility.
Political, yeah. That sense of I have no responsibility for anybody other than myself and my trust fund. And I don't understand people that don't take an interest in politics. I don't understand people that are not members of a political party. Truly, I don't. And I know, in Luxembourg, for example, where we're both originally from, roughly 10 to 15% of people who vote are members of political parties. Does that make the others all good people? No. But I don't understand, like, the bare minimum you can do is pick a political party, even if you're not a huge fan of it. You know, as long as you're aligned, kind of, just to... What does it cost you? It costs you the amount of money you would spend on average for a tea or a coffee with a sandwich.
First of all, this is an interesting point. I just want to stick on that. First of all, is the percentage higher in other countries, let's say Germany or France? I'm not familiar with the statistics. Are there more people in political parties, or is there a general phenomenon that you think that the rate of people that are active members in political parties is actually too low?
It tends to be a low percentage, but that's, I mean, there you enter a whole other discussion about education.
But I can tell you from my perspective, because I'm not in a political party, but I would consider myself to be very involved in politics, meaning I read a lot of news, I listen to podcasts, I listen to news, and I would consider myself very informed on many issues, obviously not on all issues, but definitely if you went out and we drank a beer, I'm pretty sure we could have a conversation for hours about any topic that you want, right?
Of course.
But I do have a little bit, I don't like being in a political party because I'm a very independent person and I wouldn't like to be bound by the hierarchy within the party. So I think, I'm not saying that is the reality. So maybe you can educate me and tell me how it is.
Yeah, and now I understand your question better as well. So
personal reflection. Yeah,
yeah, maybe. So I'll answer it from both sides.
Sure, right? Go ahead.
Donald Trump is not the leader of the Republican Party. Or at least he was not until a few years ago. Even after he became president as a Republican, he was not the leader of the Republican Party.
Now I'm not even sure he is a Republican, but that's a discussion.
But that's a discussion for another point. But now he is de facto the leader of the Republican Party, right? So what he did is hijacked an entire political party and made it his army.
Agreed.
So the idea that there is a hierarchy that dictates everything, no. I mean, especially nowadays, but it's always been the case. People can go in with ideas and change how things operate. And now the second thing. Yesterday, as it just so happens when we're recording this podcast, yesterday I had a meeting of the executive committee of the Democratic Party here in Luxembourg. And we had long conversations, one about pension reform. I won't mention the details because these are not open meetings. One was about pension reform and the other was about the situation, the global geopolitical situation right now. I am not an elected member of parliament, right? I am not a politician the way that other people would see. But as a person, I have chosen to be involved in a political party, starting with, you know, local involvement, understanding how my local community works, then regional involvement. And then now at the highest level of my party, I'm elected in this executive board. And we get to have these discussions. You can read the news. You can watch what the ministers go out and say on the media. But obviously, everything there is filtered. Filtered once by the common sense of the politician that's trying to communicate something, filtered twice by the person running, you know, or advising on the talking points, filtered again by a media outlet that is asking questions because there's a journalist that is also trying to guide a conversation somewhere, filtered again by how the media will publish it and where it's going to get placed, filtered again by how many people will actually interact with it and how much they will rank it on the website, and filtered again now on social media, where some algorithm will determine whether or not you get to see it. So the idea of you being informed is so far from the truth, because the source of where the actual conversation is happening is so far away from you and has been filtered so much that the idea that anyone listening to this podcast is getting better informed, you know, not because the podcast is not great, your podcast is amazing, but because there's been so many filters by the time we get there. I think if we want to be informed, we need to get involved in these systems that work. They can be online, they can be offline, but we need to be meeting each other and really understanding each other and talking to each other. That's what hasn't happened, and that's why we also see the situation in the world right now, because people have become distrustful of politicians because they haven't engaged. Politicians have a huge responsibility, don't get me wrong. But I am a person who likes to take responsibility for what I do, for my actions, for my surrounding, and sometimes it sucks, man. Let's face it, sometimes it feels awful when you are in a situation that you don't enjoy because you have to take responsibility for that hole you found yourself in, right? But we got to take responsibility for ourselves and for our involvement in society. And so what hasn't happened is for too long, people were not getting involved. Those who felt comfortable, those who felt like the system was working, did not take the time to be involved in the system and ensure that they help not only sustain it, but also keep it accountable. Of course, then you had a political class that became kind of a third player and started just protecting itself. And that's not in any country, it's in all countries. You've got a government and a political class that has really become a third actor. It feels like sometimes politicians don't represent the people, but rather represent themselves, right? So totally. But on a personal side, on the side of personal responsibility, of community responsibility, where have we been? And so you have the most extreme voices that are getting organized because they are frustrated, because they have reached that tipping point of, I cannot stay silent and I cannot stay uninvolved anymore. And now they are the ones that are organized and they are the ones pulling us apart. And of course, whenever you are in a situation where you're being pulled apart, it's much easier for any external actors to come in and divide you.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I'm trying to disentangle. There's obviously a lot of what you just said. And I think it goes at the heart of the problem that we have right now, I think, in today's society. You know, I want to go back to the example of Trump. Obviously, it's because it affects everybody, right? It doesn't only affect the United States, but it affects everybody. And I think he's a good example of, you know, getting elected, because I think you mentioned that people are frustrated and they're pissed at the inflation, at the living conditions. Life's not just not going the way they want it to, right? And, you know, and they see him and there's some sort of attraction that they have. And my question is, how do normal, sane people combat this, right? It's like, because, like, I think you and me are on the same page. We recognize, right, the dictatorial tendencies that Trump exhibits, and that the fact that he tried to overthrow the election, you know, there's just so many things that he tried to do. So how do we counteract this movement? Because he has just basically raised this MAGA army, and we see this phenomenon in Germany too, right? The AfD, just now second biggest force in the Bundestag. So there seems to be a movement in that direction. How do we counteract that and give people, again, like you said, how do we get people the power back to be active, construct in or engage in civic engagement to counter that?
Well, first of all, don't use generative AI.
Okay.
It's a joke, but actually it's very true, because, you know, Gen AI at the moment doesn't innovate, so I see a lot of people. Sorry, I just find the question interesting, and I see a lot of people trying to solve the same challenge. And what I get a lot from people is like
a generic answer.
I get the same answer. Everyone's using ChatGPT or some other Gen AI to give me, you know, strategies of what we should do.
Sure,
they're all the same, and they're also outdated because obviously it's pulling from knowledge that is completely outdated. So just that. Don't think be an independent thinker, engage in politics, as we said, engage in civic action. For me, I think I've said that a lot, but for me, voting is the bare minimum. Like, get engaged, whether it's a political party or a group or a nonprofit, get engaged, be active, have a voice. And then I think more than ever, we need to counter misinformation and propaganda. And so how do you do that when the exchange of information and the propaganda
is filtered, like you said before?
And also, but is so now it's filtered and slash, let's introduce the other thing, it's guided. Elon Musk bought the propaganda machine that is now X, right? And guided by adjusting the algorithm, by defiltering whether you were going to get to see his content or not. And so now we have these players that have no real competition, that are mostly US-based, that are heavily either allies of, you know, dictator Trump or feeling the pressure of, because I think, you know, Elon Musk, obviously crazy at best or villain at worst, but he's definitely pushing the Donald Trump agenda, or actually is, you know, effectively presiding over this U.S. government at the moment.
He's like a shadow president. I think that's the term. I like it. I think it's a very accurate description.
I mean, he's getting interviews on,
right, but
Fox News,
sure,
and CNN,
yeah,
okay, interrupting the president of the United States to give the answer that he wants to give because he's not answering, right? So, but, and then you have people like, you know, Mark Zuckerberg that I feel, you know, is also now caving in to a lot of, let's say, instructions from the White House. But I think it's just that he's feeling the economic pressure on his business. And so for me, it's really time. And I think that's why you've seen one of the projects I'm developing. It's really time that we develop competition in terms of where the exchange of information is happening, where these public digital spaces exist. I mean, what kind of public digital spaces exist? And of course, a lot of things to unpack here. I mean, what is a public space? What does public mean? What is a digital space? What is a social media network? But to counter misinformation and propaganda, we need to make sure that we improve norms. So does that always mean getting a new social media platform up and running? Not necessarily, but we definitely need more of them. We need more of them. We need to be able to speak in spaces where the filtering of information, the norms we set for how information is filtered, is totally different than the one we have right now.
Yeah, and you, I think I read a comment of yours somewhere, and I, when I read it, I actually thought, yeah, this is actually true. Because you mentioned we need our own social media platform. We need to basically separate ourselves from X and, you know, the dominance that of the U.S. market and the U.S. presidency and Musk, and create our own online digital space. Could you speak a little bit to that? Because I find it's a really interesting idea. And I was thinking, yeah, why don't we have that?
The why don't we have that is a huge conversation that I don't want to get so pessimistic.
Sure, sure. But I was thinking about my, I thought it sounds really good to me. I was like, and it's like, why doesn't it already exist? You know, because I think it's because the case you were making, the point you were making, it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. I mean, Europe has been so reliant and so trusting of American technology for decades, and for good reason. The United States as a country remains one of our traditionally biggest allies. But unfortunately, the United States that liberated Europe, that was one of the big liberators of Europe in the 40s, is no longer the United States that we're dealing with today, right? But when I say no longer, I don't think it's forever. It depends on the resilience of the United States and their ability to prevent a dictatorship from taking place at the helm of their federal government. Because if this era of Trump is another blink, then we're looking at a different environment. But if Trump settles, then it's a whole other question, right? But we haven't been able to develop them because we didn't have that ambition. We didn't dare to compete. I don't think it's about decoupling from X. I don't think it's about saying to people, stop using Facebook. People will not stop using Facebook. Their grandmother that might have passed away, you know, 15 years ago is still on Facebook and memorialized profile with all the pictures. And so, you know, people will stay there. But we need to offer alternatives. We need to at least compete. I mean, you know, when Snapchat, and Snapchat is also American, but when Snapchat came out, it forced Instagram to innovate. We tend to forget that Instagram stories are just a feature that Instagram and Meta copied from Snapchat after seeing how ridiculous a good idea it was. So it's about offering the same. It's about competing. And I think it's time for us to create alternatives. And yes, I've been trying to develop one, and I've recently, a month from now, I'll be leaving officially my current employment to go full time on building this project.
Mm-hmm. Could you talk a little bit about the project? What exactly does it entail?
Well, hopefully building a serious competitor to the main social media platforms. Obviously, we don't have the money of the Chinese Communist Party to acquire users, and we don't have risk capital in the same way that it is available in the United States. So scaling it will be different. Building it is different, and we'll have to be much, much more efficient with our marketing. Although, you know, it costs less to develop now. I mean, you know, the first prototype, I built it over a weekend just to show it to my co-founder because just, yeah. Creating a platform nowadays, creating anything nowadays digital, with the assistance of AI and coding has just become ridiculous. And by ridiculous, I mean amazing. It just makes it so accessible. I can't wait to see the next generation of European entrepreneurs. But yeah, we want to build a social media platform. We understand the realities of the market right now. It cannot be government developed because then you have roadblock after roadblock. I don't trust that, you know, governments together could have their Airbus moment again. So it needs to be done in a market, with the market. But it needs to be done with European values. And so effectively what we're building, and, you know, I don't have a problem saying it publicly on this podcast or anywhere else because, you know, I welcome anyone to do it. I don't think it's the idea that gets stolen. It's the ability to execute it. We're building a social media platform where we want to make users be in charge of their own algorithm, of how things are filtered, give the responsibility to the user. Will everyone use it? I'm guessing no, but I want to give people the chance to understand how the algorithm pushes them one way or another. So effectively, just to give you an idea through voice of the user interface, I want you to be able to tune in the same way that you would use a guitar tuner app. I want you to be able to tune your own algorithm and select how much or how little you would like to be influenced by it. And in terms of what the app will look like, my motto is, you know, I hear what they always say, America innovates, Europe regulates, and China replicates.
This is my fourth podcast.
Okay.
And I've had this said twice now by two different people who didn't know of each other. So this saying that you just said seems to be very popular right now. And which actually, and I just had this thought in my mind, because you talked about European values and what does the EU stand for, right? It seems to me that right now the EU has an image problem. I don't know if it is the reality, but this when you mention the EU to somebody, I think the first thought that pops up in their mind is regulation. They overregulate. That's all they do every day. They attach the bottle caps to the bottles. They now want to do all USB, and they just have a lot of fun regulating all day long, right? Just whenever there's something to regulate, you know, the EU will do it. Now, I don't think that is the reality necessarily, but it seems to me that that is the common perception. So what are your thoughts on this?
No, it's what I told you. The saying is the saying, and what I'm proposing is let's replicate as well. Let's learn to replicate some things. You know, innovation is happening. I don't have to reinvent what a social media app looks like. I need to build it the Amazon way, build it to a level that it makes sense, that people understand. And then from there, oh my God, the amount of innovation that's possible. If we get a user base, we can look at what others have done and say, okay, where and what can we improve? Can we become a payments platform? What more can we do on that? I mean, my goal, and I could completely fail. I could be talking to you a year from now and be like, hey, John, completely failed. Didn't work, you know. And that's awareness is key, right? Like in terms of how startups are successful or not. And that's why I'm very cautious. I'm like, I'm building my MVP. I want to build that MVP. I want to test it. I want to validate that it's possible to do it. And then we'll be talking. But at the moment, it's just about changing that mindset of like, we're not just regulators, we can innovate. And of course, there's a lot of regulation in the EU level. We're a union of multiple sovereign states with different histories, different priorities. So a lot of the time, it's Venn diagrams from hell coming to agreement on something. We need to get rid of unanimity on some stuff. If you look at the Democratic Party program for the European elections in 2024, right, mostly written by the great Charles Goerens. We all contributed to it. The party contributed to it. But really, he led that. That was a visionary program. That was a visionary program. And you have to remember, that was written before the Draghi report came out. People actually read it. It was a short program. It was really just a visionary program. It wasn't a national program about implementing so-and-so policy. It was a visionary program. So, and you see how, by the way, like my politics, my work, my anything I do is all about, or at least I hope so, about me trying to contribute something to the greater whole. So Europe needs to get rid of some red tape, but we need to be very specific about what red tape we're talking about. When you're talking about environmental protections, you shouldn't be getting rid of any red tape. You should be adding red tape, but not complexity to it. I mean, why have we made laws so difficult to understand? So step one for me, and I'm popular opinion because most of my future colleagues, if I ever go into politics, will be the case. But get rid of lawyers from politics.
You mean get rid of lawyers in politics?
Yes, we have way, way
that's like everybody. Yeah. I was like, okay.
We have way too many lawyers. Because they don't understand. They that's what they've studied. That's their expertise, and they make laws. So it sounds simplistic. It sounds.
It makes a lot of sense. I mean, it is perfect because they understand the laws. They understand how things work, and of course,
no, that's the opposite. They don't understand how things work.
How so?
They only understand how to regulate. They only understand law. If a tree needs to be planted, think about how a lawyer would plant a tree. He would never plant a tree, but he would spend 20 years talking about how the tree might be planted, where it might be planted, how it could be planted, where it might be purchased. But if you had a gardener as an MP in charge of tree planting, he would just say, we're going to be planting some trees.
Okay. I see where you're going with this. Okay, let me rephrase what I meant. I didn't mean that they necessarily have a lot of knowledge on things, but they understand how the system works, right? Because they understand how the laws work. So they know how to get around. They know how to achieve what they want to achieve.
They understand how a broken, outdated, flawed system works.
Right.
Make sure that it keeps being outdated, it keeps being broken, and it keeps being flawed.
Correct. Because they understand the law, so they can navigate them, right? I'm not saying that's the right way to do, but that's what I meant. I didn't necessarily mean that they understand, let's say they are in some sort, involved in foreign affairs. I'm not even saying, maybe they don't understand anything about the Gaza conflict, about the Russia-Ukraine war, about anything at all. But because they're lawyers, they can always get around. That was my point.
Yeah, I mean, it's very important. I mean, we lived until recently, I think, in a global system where we respect the rule of law. Rule of law and how complex that law will be. It doesn't have to be that way. For example, we can set the most ambitious environmental laws, but we can set goals. Laws can be written differently to make sure that more people are able to participate in the economy so that it doesn't feel like red tape everywhere, so that you don't have to spend more time filling out paperwork instead of creating a business, so you don't have to spend more time in the bureaucracy, in the reporting of your sustainability instead of actually being sustainable. I feel like, a small farmer somewhere in Europe who is organically farming, why would they need to spend 50% of their time filling out paperwork to prove the organic processes of their farming instead of finding a more efficient way to showcase that? It could also,
Is that part of the problem that maybe the established parties, they don't really take into consideration the concerns of the common man, like you just said, the farmer, other professions? And that I think the populist parties have picked up on that, and they ruthlessly exploited that, you know, messaging to these people. And I think it was part of it why they're so successful, I think, in many countries.
Wow. I mean, again, our conversations keep going from place to place, which is incredible. And I love that. I hope someone's going to be able to follow.
Right.
Again, there's so much, you know, and documented evidence of how this happens. And we know what populist parties exploit. And you know, it's not an accident ever that everyone's able to agree that these parties are stupid and we should never vote for them. And then all of a sudden, something happens from one election to the other.
I think it's enormously interesting to explore why, like you said, we know these parties are stupid. We know we should vote for them. But it's so fascinating to me that so many people vote for them. And I think it's very worth exploring this.
Because they present the problems, right? They don't present solutions. They present the problems and they say, shouldn't that be fixed very quickly? And here's a very, very simple solution, which is not a solution. It's kind of like, hey, yeah, we're going to deport 30 million people. Sure. But, you know, when something's done a certain way, the system always wants to protect that thing being done the exact same way. If we let lawyers, for example, right now, and it's not, I'm not going anti-lawyer rant right now. I'm just giving a specific example, yeah. Right? If we were to let lawyers implement AI in the future of the world, of how, like, you know, we use AI in our processes and our lawmaking, and if we were to imagine that artificial intelligence would not yet achieve full AGI, right?
Yeah, the AGI means artificial general intelligence, just for the audience. Yeah,
right. Yeah. So lawyers would make sure that implementing AI would actually slow down how we do things instead of...
I mean, we've already done that with the EU AI Act in Europe, to a certain degree. Couldn't you argue that this was drafted by lawyers in the EU Commission?
There, I think actually that's one of the most interesting ones that set an ambition to protect ourselves from a technology we don't fully understand yet. So I think it was important, especially when you look at how quickly AI is developing, it was important that we have set something in place. And, you know, like, I would rather...
There's another can of worms right there. Yeah,
I will not finish that sentence because I don't trust what I would actually was what I was about to say. But
I don't censor yourself.
No, it's not about censoring. It's just about how it would be construed. But it's just like there is a need to innovate. There is a need to try and test and fail is what I'm going to say. And we need to support people trying. And if we fail, we fail. But I think it's very important that if someone really tries to do something very bad, there is regulation there in place that would be able to...
Well, I think part of the regulation, as far as I understand, is also the data protection angle, right? It's like we want to make sure that we protect personal information so that it doesn't... That's at least my understanding. I'm not sure if I'm...
It's really cute that we think that we have any sort of privacy left, but yeah.
Well, I think that was the goal. That was the stated goal. Now, how in reality, it might be different, right?
I mean, other than the fact that we have to click on accept cookies on every website nowadays, the idea... The idea that we have privacy, the idea that we have privacy, come on.
But still, it's fascinating to me, like over 80% of people still don't know that when they go to Facebook, that it's not really free, that we pay with our personal information and that they sell this to advertisers. And then
Meta makes about $1,000 per user per year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Across their apps. So yeah, we're all products, if not more with other things, right? I was just talking about ad revenue. But
so then what's the point of the AI regulation, I guess, would be my question. If we know that our data is not going to protect it anyways.
Well, but the AI regulation is different to the Digital Services Act.
Okay.
Right. But, I mean, in Monet, for example, we want to make the DSA kind of standard, the global standards, whether a user is using us in the United States or in Europe, it would get the same kind of like protection from our side. But the idea that we have privacy. When I'm going to lunch later today with my friend Sarah, right? We booked the restaurant, a local restaurant here in Luxembourg. We booked it through Google. I'm going to input the fact that I'm going to that restaurant on Google later. Not because, I mean, Luxembourg is small. We all know how to get around places just to check the time because I want to see how much traffic there is. It's going to tell me how much traffic there is because everyone else is also using Google. I'm going to go to the restaurant. I'm likely going to open up one social media app, post a little picture. So there's going to be proof of where I was on Instagram forever. Then I'm going to use my Apple Pay on my Apple phone to pay with Visa. So, you know, my journey to having lunch with Sarah and having lunch with my friend Sarah will include me using at least 8 different American apps or American payment providers. And on their end, if we really, the question of privacy is, anyway, that's gone out the window. But there's so many conversations to be had about sovereignty of digital spaces. I mean, you know, I don't know if you've ever read Henri Lefebvre, The Right to Space, Public Spaces. Absolutely recommended reading.
Give me the bullet. Give me the main idea of what he's saying about. I would assume it's based on Greek, you know, philosophy, just like the public space, open space of ideas, exchange of ideas in public spaces.
I mean, no, this is from my architecture background, and I just have to say, for anyone who's still listening to this podcast, thank you for listening to mine and John's way of talking, because
we're just going down the path that, you know, we have no idea where we're going, but it's interesting nonetheless.
Yeah, I love it. It's just that you and I have had previous conversations, so we kind of know what we're talking about, and so I'm excited about this conversation, but I hope someone's able to follow. But yeah, Henri Lefebvre spoke about the right to the city and the right to space, right? And I encountered him very much both in my bachelor's and in my master's, even more. So he talks about space being socially produced. So space not being just a physical area, but a product of social, political, economic forces. And that, you know, all the power dynamics that reflects. He talks about the right to the city. He talks about capitalism and space, you know, that under capitalism, urban space has been commodified. And from there, by the way, that's where I, you know, and I think some people find it very strange that I'm a liberal and I criticize capitalism. I think any, you know, person with the ability to think is able to put a lot of criticism.
Sure, absolutely, yeah.
But I think when we talk about space, right now, you and I, we're not in the same place. We're recording this on an app, right? We live in digital spaces. Therefore, our shared urban spaces are now our digital spaces, and they have been commodified as well. We speak on Meta, we speak on Instagram, we speak on Facebook, we speak on X, we speak on TikTok. So I'm not going to be able to completely change the system. But by introducing new spaces, I think we can create competition in the market and ensure that we are able to create alternatives and therefore set new norms. You know, if we create a much healthier space than other apps, hopefully, if we get massively adopted, then other apps will also have to become healthier spaces in order to attract users. And so, you know, going back to Henri Lefebvre, see, that's the thing of knowing each other. He talks about everyday life and resistance, about reclaiming space, about, you know, he talks about resisting privatization. So I take it to a different thing about, like, you know, providing alternatives within this privatization, demanding inclusive, you know, digital urban planning. Sorry, your listeners won't know that I just air quoted. So, you know.
Right. Digital, yeah.
Digital urban planning, you know.
Right.
And
the visual aid, yes.
We just need to reclaim urban space. And in the same way that Lefebvre's ideas inspire us to, you know, have discussions on affordable housing and anti-gentrification and participatory urban design, I think we need to be thinking about these ideas around urban space.
When you say reclaim, does it mean that we have to take it back from somebody that has taken these spaces?
Of course. But because of the breadth of this conversation, it sounds simplistic, but
right.
Of course they have been taken up in the same way that we don't really have public spaces anymore, John. We don't have public spaces. We have shared spaces, right? We have spaces that we consider as public, but they're not public. When you go to a mall, is that a public space? No, it's a private space. Every inch of that space is private.
This is interesting because now I'm thinking about the distinction between public and private spaces. So you say a mall is not a public space, but a private space.
But we see it as a public space because that's where we go and it's in
right.
public.
That's what I would say if you'd ask me, yeah.
Yeah, but it's not public, is it? It's a private space with private policing. Mm. Who has authority inside the mall? It's a private...
Okay, I understand what you're saying. So basically you're saying in all the spaces that we have, whether it be offline or digital, there's always some sort of entity that actually regulates the space, and we don't have any control.
We are not regulated.
We have no control of it.
So it's, and like, I'm not saying, you know, I mean, digital spaces became private almost immediately. From the very beginning, our digital spaces have been privately moderated.
Hijacked, so to speak.
Well, I wouldn't say hijacked, but they were just supported by private capital and
they were sold to us, I guess, under the guise of a public space, saying, hey, you can talk freely, and this is a democratic space where you can freely exchange ideas.
The digital town square.
The digital town square, yeah.
Come on. The town square, Plasdam, is a public space. Plasdam is a public space.
Mm-hmm.
Is Twitter a public space? No. It's owned by literally one guy called Elon Musk. Every time you go on X, you are talking in his garden. You're invited in his garden where he sets the rules. And if he doesn't like you, he can kick you off.
So I guess in the same way then that before it was regulated by Jack Dorsey, right? So, or the same way Meta...
Jack Dorsey was the CEO. He was co-owner. But Twitter was a public company. And now we open up a whole other conversation about what has happened, because again, people are not informed about what does it mean for a company when it's public? Because essentially, I own part of Meta, so do you.
Sure.
Right?
And you could buy stocks.
Voilà. And so everybody in Luxembourg actually shares ownership of Meta, because most of our funds invest in funds that own American stocks, especially kind of like top American performing companies. And again, that's something that, you know, we were talking about with Charles Goins during the elections. But again, it's too complex sometimes for people to follow. And it's this idea that, yeah, we all own, but we don't have voting rights. We don't have voting rights, man, because we own funds through funds through funds. And so we have traded away. So even though there is public ownership of a lot of these so-called private companies, but they're public, they're publicly traded, the only people sitting on those boards are people that are actively working in the private markets for big firms that we're very lucky in a way to have here in Luxembourg, big American corporations that take active roles in leading these companies. And so effectively, and you know what I'm talking about, I'm talking about the BlackRocks, the Vanguards, the State Streets of the world. Well, there's only these. But they have the voting rights, right? So they get to decide how these platforms will be led, what norms will be set. And it's part of the market. You know, I'm not going to change the market. I'm not anti-market. I just feel like, you know, I have social liberal ideas. I'm anti-monopoly. And right now, you have a government in the United States that's very much in love with the idea of creating monopolies. Elon Musk loves monopolies. Peter Thiel loves monopolies. And remember, the game Monopoly was invented, right, to poke fun and
right.
warn people of the ills of capitalism. Capitalism doesn't have to be that way, right? When capital is allocated effectively, when capital is allocated for people's benefit, capitalism can be a force for good. But
I think, and there's a saying, you say capital is like the worst, but also the best system we have. So in a way, it's a highly imperfect system, but, you know, it's the best one we have.
It's the same thing that they say about democracy, right?
Right.
Democracy is the slowest, worst form of government ever, but show me a better one.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah. There's similarities. But I want to touch back on, because I was thinking that in preparation, And, you know, I think part of your values in your political work is, I think, civic engagement. That means you like to talk to people, explore ideas, and through discussion, you know, come to share common values and progress. So, and you also say that, you know, you're planning on exploring digital spaces and, you know, maybe coming up with something European equivalent to existing US platforms. But when you now look at how people talk to each other on social media, do you think that people talk to each other in a civil way online, or is it different than how they talk to each other in real life?
Yeah, absolutely not. People don't talk online the way that they would talk offline, right? People online feel, and I've seen that a lot, feel that, well, they confuse, by the way, what freedom of speech is. So I have some people that really come and it's normal whenever you're exposed, but they come on every one of my posts and will post stuff. And I'll let them the first time, the second time, the third time, the fourth time. But after that, I'm not going to let you use my platform to share your ideas. This is my platform. I've developed it. This is my space that you're coming into. You want to talk shit about me? Talk shit about me, but on your own thing. If you want to obsess over me and make, you know, make posts saying, oh, Crystal says this and this, but he's doing that and that, so therefore he is an idiot. Do it, but not on my thing. I'm going to delete your comment. I'm not going to give you space on my thing that I've put in time to develop. And then I'll say, oh, you know, he's deleting these comments. Yeah, of course I'm deleting.
Censorship.
Yeah, because you wouldn't find it normal. If I was coming out, right, on my balcony, sharing my ideas, you wouldn't expect me to let you be on my balcony all the time.
Yeah, I agree. I think the norm, like, goes back to the norms, right? People think that there are different norms,
of course,
online than there is in real life.
Yeah. If you come into my comment section all the time and you treat me like a piece of,
right,
I'm not gonna keep giving you that platform. I'm gonna block you.
Yeah, it's interesting, right? It almost seems like people are not aware that, you know, there's still laws. You cannot, you know, you cannot be doing racial slurs at somebody online. It's not okay if you do it online, right? It seems to be, sometimes people think it's okay if I do it online, but they would never do it in real life.
Or they think because I post something on LinkedIn and you commented on it, I have to reply to every single thing. I have better things to do. If I spent my time replying to every single person's comment on LinkedIn, I would have to have 7 full-time jobs just replying on people's comments on LinkedIn and on Instagram.
Right.
Right? So if you post and I don't reply, and you post again, and you post again, and you post, there's probably a reason why I'm not replying to you.
One would assume, yeah, I think so, yeah.
So, yeah, the problem is social media encourages people to outrage, and, you know, the platforms are designed to maximize engagement.
Yeah, so the reason I said this is because you mentioned earlier that, you know, it is important that you have this civic engagement, but I feel sometimes social media counteracts this because it creates these atmospheres where people think they are acting in a law-free room, or, you know, where nothing applies to them and they can just act in the worst way possible, which, you know, I still don't know or understand why. There's some reason, maybe there's anonymity, or it might be other factors.
Oh, it's not even anonymity. I have a person, I'm not going to name them. They work for the...
True, on Facebook, I guess people actually have their names and faces.
Or LinkedIn, that's what surprises
me. Or LinkedIn, yeah. LinkedIn,
like, where people... But that's a whole other thing, because people here, you know, this person I'm thinking of right now works for the public sector here in Luxembourg, and like the amount of stuff that I get from them, it's like, but they don't care. They have a job for life. They will never be fired, so they can harass anyone they want, you know. But I think that the solution, or a solution that I can think of, is ensure that there is some sort of accountability, that constructive discourse is promoted. So I think we need to design...
Yeah, that's why my point, all those things that are not happening on social media, basically.
Yeah, I want to design a platform that's designed for civility. You know, I told you about the algorithm adjustments. It's up to the user. I want to give power to the users. I want to give power to you to decide how you want to or not to use the platform. But I want you to be in charge of the algorithm and to reward thoughtful discussion if you so desire.
Do you think people know or understand the power of the algorithm in their daily life?
No. Majority of people don't.
Right.
They're aware of it, but they don't understand how bad it is.
Do they understand it when they go on YouTube, that once they put in or they watch one video, that the algorithm feeds them hundreds of similar videos, and that essentially reinforces their views or and their political attitudes? Do you think people see that link in real life?
I don't think most people understand that, and especially young people don't understand that. that comes into something else, right? So the algorithm is one thing, but what I love about Reddit, and again, going back to the idea that Europe regulates and China replicates, I'm replicating a lot. Like me and my co-founders, we're replicating a lot of what we think works best. And we're really trying to build a platform that we think provides a lot of solutions to the problems that we see on social media. So one, algorithmic editing. Secondly, community moderation. We're stealing this from Reddit. I think Reddit showed us a great balance between the fact-checking that Meta had employed on its apps and the kind of community nodes that exist on X now. But community nodes, you know, there's no spaces or people that you can trust that, like, oh yeah, this guy is usually the one, you know, moderating the space. Community moderation is great. Then there needs to be a reduction of anonymity overall on social media. Even though I don't think anyone's stupid enough to think they're anonymous on social media.
Yeah, not really anymore, right? I think there used to be like forums and things like that. But right now, you go to LinkedIn or Facebook, your name is attached to everything, right? Yeah.
And then there needs to be a public interest focus, right?
What do you mean by that, public interest focus?
A business model that doesn't just rely on engagement-driven ad revenue. So the margins on social, and of course, again, that needs to also happen with like the right investors. Investors being willing to test that and being willing to.
But what other model is there? Isn't that the only model right now?
No, but the margins are huge. You can reduce slightly your ad revenue.
Okay.
To begin with, because actually I think if it works well, then actually you get better ads, more targeted ads, and you can sell them for more. Again, right. Because I need to build something that investors will want to come in and invest in, right?
Sure. I got
some hate messages for that. And I'm like, hey, guys, I need to pay for video, right? Because social media now is video. And I am asking for people to trust me with their money to build this because, you know, building it, again, is easy, but rolling it out is expensive. So I still need to make sure that people that are investing in my idea are willing to invest because they think they're going to make money from it. But I think you can create a model that shows sustainable revenues and a public space that people will love. Because I genuinely, you know, I feel like public spaces, and again, public in quotes, I think digital spaces are still in their infancy stage.
If you think about it, in terms of years, it's really not that long ago that we started this whole journey on digital transformation.
You know, when you look at just how many private spaces of discussion exist, and I'm talking about cafes, you know, people don't tend to go to public spaces to talk, right? People actually, at least in our societies, we tend to go to private spaces that are open. We go to cafes, we go to restaurants, and, you know, sure, everybody loves, I don't know, Pret, and they want to go to Pret or what's famous in Europe?
Starbucks.
Yeah. I was trying to avoid saying Starbucks just because people have very
different. Yeah, we don't give them even more promotion. Everybody already knows about them.
But, you know, like, why would anyone want to go to Starbucks all the time? But, you know, I go to Interview. My favorite bar in Luxembourg City is Interview.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's slightly alternative, slightly simpler. Yeah, I'm not going to get the same level of fancy furniture or, you know, like, and I'm doing a metaphor here for, like, advanced AI filters and blah, blah, blah. I can't build that overnight and have that in my product. But wouldn't you like to hang out in a different space?
Yeah, I mean, but I think a part of the problem is that people replicate the same things over and over because they see it works. And then, you know, that's where the lack of innovation, right? There's people that are, we just going to stay with what's true and tested. And there's an element of risk involved, right? Because you're taking a risk because you're doing something that, you know, other people don't do. And I think it's hard to convince people to do that or to journey on that journey maybe sometime.
I think it's a culture thing, innovation. Innovation is a culture thing.
And now I'm going to say, in Luxembourg, there's such a almost disdain to this. And I think it's tied to the fact that if you fail at something here, it's like bad. It's like, oh no, like you fail, you are a failure. And no, it's not how you should look at it. You should be like, no, you failed at something, but you learned something, and now you're going to do something new, learning from your failure, right? And that is, from my perspective, that is just not encouraged enough here. I think there should be much more of that.
Absolutely, man. And it's exactly the same thing in most things here. When I started getting active in politics, people gave me the label. And then when I, you know, actively started, you know, advocating for one party, people gave me a label. We have an issue here with evolution. We have an issue with accepting things as non-binary. We want to put people in holes.
Boxes.
Yeah. But I would literally say holes. We want to put people in holes.
And it's harder to get out of a hole than out of a box.
Yeah. We have that in our culture, and we have some innovation agencies and all that, but the culture hasn't changed, and it's not just in Luxembourg. But in Luxembourg, I tell you, I gave my resignation a week ago now. Mm-hmm. Because in order to be able to go pursue these projects that I want to do, I had to leave. I had to take the risk. And some of the people I know told me, what are you doing? You know, you should have waited. You should have tried to get fired, go into chômage for a year, have that steady income coming in. And what are you doing? Just go in the public sector, go work, Christos. You know, you have a master's degree, you go A1, work for life. You know, they always tell me, everyone assumes that because I'm actively politically, they always also assume that I know absolutely everyone, and everyone from the government is
waiting for me to go work for them. No.
No, yeah, that's not how it works, yeah.
And it's like, okay, well, can you let me try another thing again? Ever since I was 17 years old.
There's very little tolerance for going a different way than the ones that is societally prescribed, right?
Yeah.
So, and I feel that. And you know, there's definitely a lot to say about this. And that's what I wish we would, if somebody asked me, what would you say we could learn from the U.S.? Is that that's definitely something. Like, their attitude towards innovation and their attitude towards failure is much more open-minded than it is here in Luxembourg. I don't know, maybe in other countries it's a little bit different in Europe, but I would assume probably not. But that is something I think we should copy. Definitely from the US.
Absolutely. At least the support for innovators and increasing culture of risk capital. Hugely important. In the same way that the US though has to learn from us in terms of creating social safety nets, right?
I'm not going to go into this one because I know we're at the end of our time, but that's a whole nother area. But before I let you go, there's one thing I want to discuss with you, and I found it very interesting. You had, in a previous interview, you mentioned a metaphor. You said that you were driving in your car, in your nice Luxembourgish car, down the road, and you saw an accident on the street. And then you said, well, that's kind of the European Union. We're in a safe car traveling down the road, but I guess your metaphor is that one moment of inattention can derail everything, right? Could you maybe touch on that? Because I think it's a really interesting metaphor that you used. I don't know if you remember using that metaphor.
Absolutely, I remember using it. I was talking to Jérôme Bloch before the...
Yeah, that's what I saw, correctly.
The European elections. And we are an accident waiting to happen.
Yeah.
I think there's many moments of inattention, right? I didn't elaborate more in that interview about this specific metaphor, but I think it's many moments of inattention. It's been many years where we haven't been paying attention to the grease in the car. We haven't been paying attention to the oil. We haven't noticed what has become rusty. We've added a lot of fancy little things in our car on the inside. Oh my God, it's a luxury car. It's beautiful inside. Oh, we've made it so comfortable and we're cruising and the suspension still works. We're not even feeling the bumps in the road.
No.
Feeling the cracks. But the machine underneath has so many issues and the steering wheel is about to break and we're going to lose control. And what's worse now, and I hadn't anticipated then, I really hadn't anticipated it then, even though we all knew. And the closer it got to the American elections, we all knew. We had our illusions, but we all knew Donald Trump was going to win, right?
Which, the first time or the second time you did it?
Yes.
This now, like the
most recent.
The most recent one. Okay.
And not only are we going to crash, but there's people actively trying to make us crash. And we're not even sure we want to be driving the car right now. I mean, there's a version of the metaphor where you have 27 people, 27 leaders trying to drive a car, and one steering on the right, one steering on the left. There's some people trying to keep it on course. And at any given moment, you don't know who's going to pull right, who's going to pull left. And I mean, we're not united. It's a crucial moment for Europe. And I am very pessimistic in a way, but I guess I'm just determined to do what I can to make sure that I can contribute where and as much as I can to prevent a crash. But I am pessimistic at the moment, because when I look at, unfortunately, how little people in Luxembourg understand the European Union, and when I look at how some Luxembourgish people, you know, our compatriots, view the situation in our neighboring countries right now, and when we don't feel that it's necessary to jump on the springboard and innovate in terms of our democracy right here, then you realize that if we can't get it at the heart of Europe, there is not a place in Luxembourg, there's not a single village in Luxembourg where you don't drive less than an hour to get to the highest court in this European Union of ours. And that's the European Court of Justice in Kirchberg in Luxembourg City. Anywhere in Luxembourg can drive to the European Court of Justice in less than an hour. We are a European capital. The whole country is a European capital, because people say, oh, Stadt Luxembourg. But actually, come on. I mean, in most places, a city and any place an hour out of it is just the city and itself.
Yeah, it's like the periphery, yeah.
So we are a European capital. And even in this European capital, we don't feel necessary that we don't understand the importance of innovating and showing the way forward. And by innovating and showing the way forward, 2025 is the year that we're supposed to be talking about electoral law reform. Do I think we're going to talk about the European electoral law reform the way I'm thinking about it? And I hope you understand what I'm saying. I don't think so. I don't think we're going to reopen the question of who gets to vote in our democracy. And I think that's such a shame, because I absolutely see the dangers of opening up voting to everybody. And actually, I would advocate for stricter rules about, you know, who, when not Luxembourgish, is able to vote. And I would also advocate for making it slightly more difficult to become a Luxembourgish citizen, not in terms of language of culture, you know, if you live here long enough, but live a little longer. I think 5 years for the citizenship for me is too short. But that has to do with a different type of decision, right? But electoral law reform. And I'm saying, if we as a country cannot propose, I mean, we're small enough to be able to test it, propose how to change who gets to participate and how decisions are being taken, how can we expect Europe to come together? How can we expect Europe to start acting more united? How can I expect a big country like Germany to get its house in order? So I'm slightly pessimistic about where we are in the world right now.
So if you were to say, okay, let's say 5, 10 years, let's say 10 years down the road, what is your best case scenario and what is your worst case scenario of where we are right now, based on everything that's going on right now?
Wow.
That's a good last question, right?
Yeah, because the best case scenario is slightly utopic, because I know it's unattainable, but I'll still say it because you asked me for the best case, and the worst case scenario is awful. So best case scenario is that with the further development of artificial intelligence, we have learned to harness the benefits of it. We have learned not to misuse it for simple and stupid things like, hey, what dog food should I get for my dog that has had an allergy yesterday to a toy? Like, don't waste water and energy on using Gen AI for this. I start with that just to say that hope that our collective conscience around the environment and our energy has developed, even though it might have been a stupid example. I hope 10 years down the line, Europe has come together to protect the environment. I hope it has come together. I hope we live in a federal European Union. And let's not forget that the United States model of federation gives huge power to each individual state. Countries would still be incredibly sovereign, but we need a federal model that works for us.
Mm-hmm. So in federal model, you would look at the EU member states similar to the US states in the United States.
No, that's what I'm saying. A federal model, but that works for us. So whatever we figure out as working for us, it could be a two-tier EU, as described by many of us last year, of, you know, who wants to subscribe? Who wants to be a part of that federation? But without causing a split, right? But I won't go further into that. But I think I'll be very happy if the EU has survived and thrived in the next 10 years. Worst case scenario, 10 years down the line, unfortunately, we might have seen a war. We might have seen huge disruption. I don't know, man. I honestly don't want to. All I know is that in 10 years from now, people will still want to live good lives. People will still want to provide safety for themselves and their families. People will want water. People will want food. People will want heated homes. And a lot of these things, I'm not sure that we will be able to guarantee in Europe if we don't get our house in order. It sounds ridiculous, I know, but to anyone who's still listening to this wonderful recording, I think, you know, if 1% of your listeners are still listening and 1% of those listeners understand what I'm saying, I think it's foolish to ever avoid thinking about the worst case scenario, because it's absolutely plausible to imagine that what happens this year, you know, because 10 years down the line, and the worst case scenario 10 years from now is not something that happens 9 years from now, is what happens this year. So if we fail to end the war in Ukraine, and if Putin decides to invade the Baltic states, and if NATO doesn't trigger Article 50 altogether, and if countries don't respond, and if our collective security mechanism fails, and if people begin to start testing, and if all these ifs that I just need to focus on the contributions that I can make, not the positives, the contributions I can make. I'm not an optimist by ignorance. I'm an optimist by design and work. You know, I'm just doing one tiny thing. I'm trying to create a social media platform where information can be fact-checked, where civility can be promoted, where algorithms can be edited and one can be in charge of. And I hope that others are doing their other efforts and other contributions in the same way that you're doing this with your podcast. You know, I mean, you know, we can't all save the world at scale, but we all contribute to it. All I can tell you is exactly a year ago, I was talking to another friend that it's just started a media endeavor. And she was messaging me and saying, oh, Christos, it's hard. You know, now I just hit 300 followers. Whenever you do something consistently and you strive to improve, you get there. It doesn't mean you're going to have the world's biggest podcast. But if you keep doing this for a year, you'll see you're having an impact. My friend now, 1 year later, we laughed the other day. I was like, I told her, do you remember you telling and me telling you, I want you to have 5,000 followers by the end of the year? And you're like, Christos, c'est pas possible. I was like, yes, it is. And now she runs one of the largest media accounts here in Luxembourg and has a huge audience throughout the French-speaking world. We all contribute to the world. She has contributed. I'm obviously talking about this wonderful feminist media here in Luxembourg that started about a year ago called Les Frontés. There's many Isbels in Luxembourg, you know, promoting women's rights, and there's many feminist media, but nobody as committed and as hardworking as the person running Les Français. And so all of us get to contribute, right? So I'm doing my small contribution. You're doing your small contribution. Alice is doing her small contribution. All of us are doing something. And as long as there's enough of us engaging and doing our civic engagement, whether through business, through traditional politics, or through parapolitics, which is all of this, then I'm hopeful that we can be working towards the better scenario 10 years down the line.
Yeah, and I think it's important that there are still people like us, right, that are driven by, I call it idealism, right? So we're driven by our ideas, we're driven by purpose. We want to contribute, even if it's only a really small part. And like you said, it's just important that you do it. And in what form you do it, that's up to you. But, you know, and I think that's part of the civic engagement, right? Is everybody does their part, and then hopefully you can have a better future. I mean, wait, this was a really interesting conversation, Christos. I mean, thank you so much for joining me. You know, this is what I'm trying to do. You know, it's obviously a long form conversation. You know, it's not really bound by any restrictions. You know, it's not like these 5-minute TV interviews where you come in with your talking points, right, and you have to stick to them. This is really about exploring ideas, getting to know the person and their ideas. And I think you did a really great job laying out what you believe in. And yeah, I wish you a lot of luck, you know, with your new social media platform. I hope that works out really well for you. It's a really interesting project. And yeah, I hope we can get together another time in the future, talk about some other things.
Let's do that again. Let's have another talk 1 year from now, and I think it'll be interesting.
Yeah, I think it'll be interesting. You know, reconnecting and then see where we are in a year from here.
Going back to what we were just saying before, you know, the idea of, like, you know, either I will be telling you, you know, about an update about how this is going, my project, or I'll be telling you, hey man, I failed and now I'm trying something else. And I think that's how you change the culture.
Yeah, let's stay in touch. Let's do that. Sounds good. Thank you so much, Christos.
Thanks, John.